Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, returning for another adventure into the harrowing depths of darkness, this time examining the mysterious unsolved disappearance of 50-year-old Robert Hoagland from Newtown, Connecticut on July 28, 2013. Robert was a family man who met his wife Lori in college while both were studying to become culinary professionals. Robert went on to work for years as a chef in various capacities before switching careers shortly before his disappearance, instead becoming a real estate appraiser who worked independently. He supplemented that income by working as a clerk at a law firm, a position he acquired through an acquaintance. Meanwhile, Lori is a culinary arts teacher at Newtown High School, where Sandy Hook shooter Adam Lanza had been a student prior to the shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary School. Lanza had first gone to the high school on that day to perpetrate the massacre, but upon realizing that a cop was outside the building, he changed directions and went to the elementary school. Most people believe there is absolutely no connection between that event and Robert's disappearance, and that any attempt to connect the two is the product of conspiratorial internet maniacs, but they're wrong. There is, without a doubt, a link between the two cases, if only psychological and/or symbolic in nature. This disappearance happened only months after the shooting, and in the same section of Newtown, Sandy Hook, where the Hoagland family lived. So if there's anything going on in Robert's life that resonates with the situation that occurred at Sandy Hook Elementary, it's going to hit him hard. One thing I can never stress enough about brain function is that events do not take place extraneous to necessity, meaning that everything that happens in our world is interconnected in a manner that definitively suggests that all energy must balance to zero. We create nothing in terms of matter and information, which are truly one and the same, and we also destroy nothing. All we have in this world is positively charged energy, negatively charged energy, and a transcendence point between. It's this simple. If there's a football game going on at Newtown High School, there are only three possible outcomes for that game. One is positive, meaning the team wins. On the opposite end is negative, meaning the team loses. If the score remains equal on both sides at the end of the game, or balanced, akin to being zero, or redundant, then that's an acceptable result as well. But there are only wins, losses, and ties because there is absolutely nothing else happening in our universe except the constant shift between these positive and negative values balancing to zero. When you go to a get-rich-quick seminar and the scumbag running it, the one making all the promises, tells you that you can be rich just like he is, all you need to do to realize the truth about what it would take to get there is to look at the circumstance in which you find yourself. You simply would have to assemble an entire room full of people who were willing to lose so that you could win. There's that old joke about placing an ad in a newspaper promising to tell everybody how to get rich if they just send you a dollar. That's how it works. It's simple. Your wins by scientific, aka evolutionary necessity, must be accompanied in the world by equivalent loss. So if the Newtown High School football team wins, the team they play has to lose. Therefore, our emotional lives are also constructed in accordance with that notion, giving us the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat. A tie game, of course, gives us neither, as it's a neutral charge. It's neither negative nor positive. Unfortunately, the social veil facilitates a drama in which we punish each other with notions of the world working as we perceive it, rather than how science dictates. So if somebody isn't successful enough, or can't stop using drugs, or has problems with this issue, or that one, we arrogantly suggest that they just don't want to change, that all that needs to happen is that they have to commit to it, they just need to be stronger. That is absolutely not how the world works in terms of evolution, but the social facade does work that way, because it is about presentation. It is about what you see rather than what's actually happening. Please remember that every time you win, no matter how you win or where it comes from, someone else somewhere in the world loses. You might live a life in which the losses are so great in number, you wonder how you've even survived. And yet, as you suffer that greatly, it allows somebody else in the world, or many people, to enjoy greater ease of existence. It's not difficult to see. We can have very few people, like Tom Brady, who make endless millions of dollars, win many sports championships, and marry wealthy supermodels, living a fairy tale life, to say the least. But for all of that winning, there had to be losers on the other side. We actually know it's a fact. We can quantify them. There's record of it. And for all of those positive charges, there have to be negative ones, aka losses. Infinity is nothing more than a zero or nothingness twisted into a track or loop that alternates positive and negative charges with a transcendence point in between at the intersection where the roads meet. That's how we get the concept of the intersection of the seeker and the sought. We were not put here absent of purpose or design, but what clouds this assessment in everyday life is that people base reality on their perception, meaning what I see is real, what I experience is real, rather than science. When approaching a case like this, meaning the disappearance of Robert Hoagland, people think, why would this man leave? As though this thing we call reason actually exists. We have this ludicrous facade, as enjoyable as it might be, where we all sit around looking at each other with skepticism, as though we're contemplating the truth and only making choices based in critical thinking and reason. Those things don't exist, however, at least not beyond perception, and simply because they cannot. Free will, or agency over consciousness, would necessitate the universe having been constructed in a different manner, specifically one which negates the need for positive and negative charges to balance to zero. The novelist Kurt Vonnegut once said, "Everything is nothing with a twist." That's our existence. Infinity is a zero which has been twisted into a figure eight to create a loop of positive charge on one side, negative on the other, and a transcendence point of neutrality in between. Red shifted light, aka that which is going away, and blue shifted light, that which is coming toward us, merge in the middle in the same way two boxers do in the ring, and the same way that matter and antimatter did after the Big Bang. They must collide to create something new. What was and what will be collide to make now. That's the same way you get your sense of self, and it continues to change because, of course, time keeps moving. So, again, that's the present, the thing you know as identity. That's why it's so fleeting, why you can never quite become the person you want to be before you're already somebody else. Those collisions keep making a new copy or version of you per quantum mechanics. And you know from experience that the losses or negative charges are the things in your heart that hurt and the ones you try to heal through wins or positive charges. You live within a very narrow three-dimensional frequency that accounts for an astonishingly tiny piece of the overall construction of the universe, and one which has been built with great attention to deception as a means of pacing evolution through reverse engineering the broken pieces, or halves, created by making the singularity a binary universe in the Big Bang. In order to pace this existence, or story, aka history, his story, it must be constructed of a series of positive and negative charges that alternate like switchbacks up a mountain or a zipper going up a jacket, getting us to the top of the mountain, so to speak, or deification at the point of the singularity, bringing the binary halves of the universe or jacket together in a merger as one. And this is apparent even in society today, on a superficial level, as you can just look at the world in front of you, and whereas we did not have very many non-binary people in the past, now we have quite a few, and that percentage will continue to rise over time, and ultimately, everybody will be non-binary within the context of artificial intelligence. That is movement toward the singularity. So, the manner in which this universe is constructed, from start to finish, is one in which positive and negative charges will flip-flop back and forth until the story is over. To do that, you need mindless worker ants, so to speak, to reverse engineer the process, as a binary universe necessitates both matter and antimatter. But if these mindless worker ants only performed their functions, understanding this was their plight, then it would be apparent that nothing could change from the architectural plans. Like ants, we would just perform the function, moving from one place to the next. But watch what happens by way of binary necessity. In a binary universe, we must have dark and light, and so our experience must be one in which we perform a function in the light, the truth of which is hidden in darkness. That's not a theory, it's necessity. A binary system must have shadows. Therefore, your functionality and mine are readily apparent before our eyes, but the nature of that process is concealed in order to allow the social facade of life. Now, what this process does is it takes the binary concepts of justice and injustice, or positive and negative charges, and adds feeling or emotion, which dictates the extent to which something is a positive or negative charge, but only in terms of a facade. So, if you're the creator, you have to create a world in which a total lack of justice becomes one where justice finally prevails as equality. Equality is the social veils term for what I describe as the singularity in evolution. When everybody is the same, or thought of as the same, we are equal, we are one. And again, that requires extraction of gender so that we are all non-binary instead of binary at the end. So, you live in a world in which we can only have justice through the facilitation and eradication of injustice, which creates a problem, ironically, for the creator by way of architectural necessity. If you make a binary universe in which positive and negative charges have to balance, there is going to be a lot of suffering. A lot. But the mechanism by which we live also necessitates worship of the creator. Something that's also ironic, because why the hell would you worship that which causes you suffering intentionally? It betrays what we understand as logic. And so, the simple solution that allows the creator to avoid blame is to utilize the avatars, aka people, to dish out the injustice. Therefore, we have a world in which everybody is blaming the next person for their suffering, as proven by the fact they can see these bad people taking those actions, and yet those people must be constructed that way by the creator, or the universe cannot function as intended in a binary format. So, the result is that we live in a world where we blame the created rather than the creator. And it's getting to a point in our understanding where that is incredibly silly. I mean, you might get upset that you burned a cake in the oven, but you don't blame the oven because the oven simply did exactly what it was designed to do. Think of yourself watching a movie. The characters you see on screen are simply images, and though they have illusory free will and believe they can make choices born of agency, you and I know that it's a scripted product, and no matter how much the character changes, this thing is infinitely simulated. Michael Corleone can't get up from the dinner table in The Godfather without shooting his enemies. He can't change his mind. If you watched that movie in the 1970s, or 5 minutes ago, or even 10 years from now, he will always be a character who was designed to perform the same function into infinity, precipitating the same outcome. Yet, knowing this, we still watch the movie over and over again. Why? The answer is drama. The illusion of free will creates a drama in which there are nearly infinite possibilities for what happens next, and assumes what's already happened was a result of choices derived from the agency of individuals and groups in power. When we watch The Godfather, while we know Michael isn't going to leave the table without fulfilling his destiny, the illusory allure of choice betrays sensibility. If your world is planned out of necessity by arranging a series of positive and negative charges balancing to zero and presented in a three-dimensional format allowing depth, you can facilitate the only question any of us has ever cared about in this world. What happens next? Even if what happens next is planned, creating ignorance in the subjects acting out those roles in the story allows for the illusion of possibility beyond the script. If you clean toilets for a living, and always will, you still get to have a brain that will make relentless suggestions to you that there's a better way, that you can do it, you just have to want it. And people around you will tell you that you just have to work hard and want it, and if you don't, it won't happen. But that's the only reason it won't, because you didn't want it enough, or you didn't work hard enough, or because somebody held you back. That's a huge crock of bullshit, okay? If you make a world with gas pumps, someone has to operate them. If you have fast food restaurants, someone has to work there. If you want to win an Olympic medal on TV in front of an adoring crowd, those people must be something far less than what you are and have no hope of ever being that in order to balance the energy to zero. If we're going to have lotteries in which someone wins $500 million, then an enormous amount of people will have to experience a negative charge of losing the money they put into it in order to facilitate the positivity garnered by the winner. In order for anybody to be special, if for a moment or even a lifetime, other people like you and I must suffer. And if some people are winning on any given day, then those wins must, out of necessity, structurally, be balanced by losses. All the time, I listen to people crying about their bad habits like procrastination, overeating, or lack of exercise, and in combination with things like depression, anxiety, and all sorts of other mental ailments. I complain about such things too. It sucks. But what we must understand is that the universe cannot have everybody being potent at the same time, looking great, adding up wins, and feeling marvelous. If you are procrastinating, or eating poorly, or depressed, or anxious, and without explanation beyond a desperate attempt to connect life events to their onset, the hard truth you don't want to hear, simply because it means you can't change your reality, is that you must lose sometimes to facilitate the wins of others. You have to be sidelined. This isn't a difficult concept, and if you're a parent, this should be especially familiar to you. You will rack up personal losses from emotion to money to give your kids wins. Now, here's why the system works in the end. Let's say you work at a bank and I come in to apply for a home loan. I'm seeking a positive charge by getting the money to buy the house, and if you, as the bank, give it to me, you'll endure a negative charge balancing to zero and placing a debt upon the borrower and a deficit upon the lender. But over time, by way of interest, which is the financial equivalent of progress or justice on a social level, the binary nature of our two-sided agreement at the bank will ironically allow those values to merge from positive and negative to a singularity or one of neutrality where we meet in the middle at the end when the debt is paid. The borrower owes no more, and the lender expects to receive nothing further, balancing their interaction or merger as a singularity to zero in terms of necessity. But what's left over is profit or financial gain created by the merger, which on a social level equates to progress towards social justice. This is why social justice is incremental, why we don't just say, hey, racism is bad, sexism is bad, hurting people is bad, and we should and will stop right this moment. We can't. The first thing that happened at the moment of the Big Bang is exactly what I just described with the bank situation. The world has never been different. When the Big Bang occurred, creating a binary universe from a singularity, that left us with a positive reality, aka matter, accompanied by a negative reality, aka antimatter. At this time, the matter and antimatter attacked each other, seeking a neutral charge, and destroying everything created by the Big Bang, with the exception of 1 in a billion particles of matter. Like liberals in relation to conservatives, there is always just slightly more matter than antimatter as a means of ensuring minimal incremental progress. You see yourself as a person due to the image in the mirror and the illusion of personhood, but the system of binary collisions of matter and antimatter rendering incremental progress is truly all that we are and have ever been. You could dress this pig up as anything you want, but it's a pig. So, whereas someone with an average intellect says, "Ah yes, the dinosaurs died because they couldn't adapt, and Darwinism will take care of all the idiots who don't vaccinate," I'm like, hello, Charles Darwin never saw a computer, never knew about quantum mechanics, never knew about anything involving physics, or even so much as saw a display of electric light in public. He didn't know what binary coding was, and again, certainly didn't have any type of a grasp on quantum mechanics pre-20th century. This guy died in the 1880s. Darwin produced brilliant work that detailed the changes of species over time, but there's a hilarious irony in writing something called On the Origin of Species without any knowledge of the foundational technology that creates them. Darwin was like, yeah, they willed themselves to adapt, and people just jumped on that train because it indulges the notion of free will and agency of existence. If Darwin was able to pop his head into the world today, he would be red-faced and blushing, the first to admit he was dead wrong about the manner in which things are created and adapt. We do not adapt by necessity. We adapt to accommodate a story, like characters featured in a movie. And of course, he didn't know that because he never fucking saw one. Yes, we will change and keep changing, but those changes have been written. So getting back to the point, because of this interconnected nature, events like the Sandy Hook shooting have implications that extend far beyond those we see in front of our eyes. Our Creator does not interfere in our world, as perfection is inherent in the design of evolution, in the same way it is in a movie you watch on screen. If you watch The Godfather right now, Francis Ford Coppola does not walk into your living room, yell cut, and start making changes to the film. The characters will behave as designed, out of necessity, and are infinitely simulated in the sense that no matter how much they change on screen, it's scripted. Otherwise, the story is ruined. You can't have a story where everybody just gets to do what they want. That's insane. We are just like the characters in a movie. The images are real. The emotions are real. The wins and losses are felt. But they are not people with free will. They are images born of necessity, and that necessity is to tell a story, the lesson of which, by its result, cannot be arbitrary or random. It must be intentional and by way of design. So if the universe is binary, the only way to make the story move forward is collisions between positive and negative energy that desperately try to maintain balance at zero. That's us. If we feel low, we try to go higher. If we feel too high, then we try to come down. Under the social veil, on an emotional level, we refer to that balance as peace. Now, to incorporate such a massive undertaking in terms of the math, there have to be a lot of intricate entanglements among events that just don't seem related on a superficial level. But they are. They all are, and it's because they must be. So, if we look at the Sandy Hook Elementary shootings, which took place in Robert Hoagland's Sandy Hook section of Newtown only months before his disappearance, what theme will we find that correlates to his life? What's the worst part about that massacre? Let's ask that. As a parent, what's the worst fear you could possibly project upon the notion of your child being shot at school? The obvious implication is that they could suffer and die, which is horrifying, but the following is worse, much worse. Knowing they're not going to grow up, that those little faces are frozen in time, never able to go on and do all the wonderful things you hope for them in the future. All decent parents want that for their kids, the opportunity to enjoy and experience life. And when a young child dies, no matter the manner in which it happens, their life being cut short is the most painful part. No prom, no college, no sports, no anything. No chance to find themselves in their passions. And worst of all, no beautiful memories to come. They just die and never return. To a certain extent, at least symbolically, all parents relate to that because their children, even if successful and healthy, grow to adults and never return to their previous innocence. They're gone, just memories. But if your child grows to an adult and fulfills the opportunity to transcend to being a successful adult or parent of their own, then you create balance in your emotions because it's bittersweet. You lose something, but you gain something. You lose them to growing up, but you gain their transcendence to becoming you. And that's the most beautiful part of legacy, right? Now, for the parents of the Sandy Hook victims, there are no words that could possibly offer comfort. That shooting was about as bad as it gets, relatively speaking. So try to imagine yourself as Robert Hoagland at home in Sandy Hook, learning about the shooting nearby that took the lives of very small children who would never get to grow up. These kids had so little life experience. I mean, they were cut short at such a young age. Now, when do things resonate with us most? Let's ask that. The answer is when we can relate them directly to our own situation, and most specifically, our suffering. If you lost a child in a school shooting and saw a devastated parent on TV who suffered the same, you might feel this so greatly that you reach out to the person. But let's say you lost a child to a drowning incident and then heard about the Sandy Hook tragedy. You wouldn't feel any less empathy or sympathy because the manner of death was different. It's the principle or theme that matters. Losing a child who never gets the opportunity to grow up. That's painful, because it's forever. You get to live with that memory forever because they don't create any more for you to indulge, right? So, as I hear about the Robert Hoagland disappearance and people suggesting there's no connection to the Sandy Hook massacre beyond internet trolls insanely manifesting a false one, I'm like, hold on, people. Hit the brakes. I got news for you. I don't even need to fucking look to see if Robert Hoagland is hurting because one of his children never grew up. I already know. And if this story is about positive and negative charges with the goal of finding balance in the middle of the transcendence point, I know Robert Hoagland's middle child not growing up is the issue here in this disappearance. I've talked about the symbolic implications of the Virgin Mary of Nazareth being the transcendence point, birthing Jesus Christ in the middle without sex, marking our transcendence from humanity to deity, or reproduction to replication, beginning with the change from BC to AD, or time going in reverse to time going forward on a loop. M and N, like Mary of Nazareth, break the English alphabet in half. So if we think of the break between BC and AD like the wings on a butterfly vibrating, and then do the same for Robert's middle son, who we know isn't growing up or transcending to become the father, what we will likely find in this case is that the middle son's name starts with M, of course, and Naturally, his name is Max. Now, we learn Max hasn't died young as a child or been severely disabled in an accident or crime, forever changing his life. So, in the absence of those terrible fates, the implications of not growing up would have to be related to something emotional, which, when manifested physically, left him with a problem caught in a cycle when he needed to be going in a straight line toward manhood. The most direct representation of the plus-minus or positive-negative pursuit manifested for mental illness is drug addiction. People try to go up or down depending upon what they feel at any given time, and in an effort to get even, so to speak, in the same way revenge works, you seek balance. Someone does something terrible to you, you do something terrible to them. If your peace is taken by anxiety, you might do something to come down. If that balance is taken by depression, you come up. It's the physical manifestation of an emotional issue and causes people to go in circles in their lives instead of going ahead along a straight line into the future. So, Robert's and Lori's middle son, Max, who was about 23 or 24 at the time of Robert's disappearance, supposedly has an issue with drugs that's not only affected his prospects for the future, but also his parents' ability to help him any longer. He lives at home, is unemployed, and seems to indulge the usual sociopathy associated with being able to afford addiction in a circumstance in which you don't have sufficient income, if any at all. The man-child drug addict of this sort, who lives at home and uses the leverage of his parents' fear he'll die if they kick him out and let him fend for himself, is a nightmare for anyone with grown children. Instead of garnering respect through accomplishment, he precipitates an air of fear in relation to the fact that any reluctance on their part to comply could lead to things that might get him killed. So the parents are left with a dilemma in which they're damned if they comply and damned if they don't. At least, they believe there is no sink or swim. They know the man-child will sink, and so does he, which allows him to utilize that notion very powerfully as the elephant in the room. And that seems to be the case here. In the times when Robert and or Lori shelled out some resources, such as usage of a family car or money, they did so knowing it was likely going toward drugs. Being decent people who want not only their son's survival, but what's best for him, creates an irony in which they also get trapped in a cycle where they alternately have to help and deny help. And look at that, helping and denying help. What's that doing? It's a manifestation of balancing to zero. But again, it's a manifestation. It isn't emotional. That's how the addict uses emotional investment to pull loved ones into utilizing their logic. It's a false presentation of balance. You might say to yourself, if you're unfamiliar with this sort of thing, well, I wouldn't give that kid a dime. I'd toss him out, sink or swim. And some people do. But others simply don't have the courage to do it because they know shoving the man-child out the door and locking it behind him won't change anything in his head. What's more likely to happen is that if and when the parents cut him off, even if slowly, as it seems to have happened here, he's going to start to resort to more and more drastic measures to get what he wants. That usually means crime of some type. And if he's still living in your home, but you're trying to impose rules to cut him off from drugs, the reality is that you're the most likely people to become victims of his crime. Normally, it amounts to theft of anything from cash to electronics to cars, but there are plenty of instances in which murder transpires, even if unintentional. It's a dangerous position to be in as a parent because it doesn't matter that the addict loves you. If you stand in the way of the drugs, you could get run over for the effort. So needless to say, parents who have to live with a son like this in their home as an adult often feel hopeless and helpless and indulge potential solutions that are as cyclical and manifested as the logic of the infected minds with which they're constructing it. Accordingly, Lori and Robert are planning to take their son Max on an extended hike into the Appalachian Mountains later that summer, believing it might just be the thing he needs to get away from the drugs. Now look at that. You use drugs if you're trying to manage a problem in your head. So creating space from drugs doesn't create space from the problem because it's emotional and inside your mind. They're thinking of the symbolic implications of climbing the mountains and accomplishment as a means of taking his mind away from the drugs to a place where it can see the possibilities. Climbing a mountain is like building a future, right? They're thinking he just needs to see he can get to the top and do it sober. But what he would undoubtedly be thinking about while he was there is scoring more drugs. He's been to rehab repeatedly. He's been arrested. Mountains aren't going to impress him. Basically, they can keep him at home where he'll keep using drugs and using them for what he needs, or they can kick him out and let the sink or swim model take its course. Yet, if we look at the theme in this case, as stated throughout, look where they remain. In the middle, on the fence, helping and also denying help. And so, accordingly, look where their son remains. In the middle, on the fence, between childhood and adulthood. He's stagnant. They've achieved balance, but ironically, it doesn't come by way of positive and negative charges colliding, so it nullifies any type of movement or adaptation that might be considered evolution derived from the merger of binary values to make something new. The man-child stays a man. The parents stay parents of a child. The only growth opportunity exists emotionally within the child's head. And even that is only a potential solution at best. The world, by order of necessity, is designed so that some people will overcome their drug problems and some will not. Those binary values facilitate a veiled social drama in which we believe anyone has the free will to do something, but only being strong gets you there. When someone else has a problem and we're stronger in relation to that issue, part of the process of trying to help them is self-congratulating our innocence in relation to their guilt, giving us stronger character, which is an indication we've utilized free will to do good in the world and be wholesome. Yet, in order to have feelings of superiority, we must have oppositional inferiority. So, morality in society allows a mechanized system of pulleys and levers in which bad people or negative charges exist in opposition to good people or positive charges. As time goes on, the things we all agree upon as evil are very slowly but surely extracted from the world around us, forcing a circumstance in which the faster evolution moves, the more we must disagree upon what constitutes that evil. We must have different ideas of it, and increasingly so as evolution moves faster because we are no longer utilizing violence to evolve to the extent we did in the past. That evolutionary warfare must become information-based and digitized. It has to. And that means, in a very big way, that intellectual warfare as a means of evolving has arrived. You see it on social media every day. People are more divided on social issues than ever before. And the truth, which seemed attainable in the past, even if murky, is buried beneath so much bullshit now that a lifetime of wielding a pitchfork couldn't possibly get you to the bottom of the pile to know what's real. That's the point. And what's rough about it, even though we have modern comforts, is that the reasons we've been afforded these comforts is that we're losing our fucking minds and have little else to indulge beyond manifesting feeling. The mental health crisis at play in the world right now, especially in developed nations where it's starting to be addressed, is absolutely frightening. There are very few people who aren't a total mess, and even the ones who have it together are struggling more than they ever have. We have extremely divisive politics, informational wars about science, and even denial of science. Everything is game. Even the insane conspiracies that plague just enough people to scare the shit out of everybody else. The whole point is to slowly but surely reveal what we really are. The fighting that goes on in society today is tiresome and damaging in a way that will precipitate major changes to our construction, both anatomically and intellectually. As I've said before, the pandemic is also a preview of that. Those masks are screaming, "Hey, get rid of the mouth and the nose. Without them, no fucking virus." It is a call to technological advance. But meanwhile, we're all screaming at each other. But that's the point. You must get crazier. We all must go absolutely batshit crazy because the whole point is to get out of these heads. We want to advance to artificial intelligence. And the way to get there is by being broken, right? So that's why you have mental illness. Now, life is one giant billboard for evolutionary necessity. We need to realize that evolution utilizes foreshadowing, symbolism, talisman, and all of the other tricks of the trade we know in storytelling that end up on the page. And they have to be simple. Birds make us want to fly by building things like them. The mask on your face, specifically over the mouth and nose, which are causing death, says, "Hey people, it's time to subconsciously begin thinking about what's coming ahead." In literature, we often only realize symbolism in retrospect. In fact, it's most effective that way because it works like our memories. You look back upon an experience with greater hindsight due to time passing and gaining more experience and think, "Oh, that's why it happened." So, in Robert's story, in relation to his son Max, that narrative will be crystal clear. I see the emotional elements manifested in this disappearance. They tell a story to which we aren't fully privileged, as he disappeared, but his disappearance foreshadows why. Given that understanding, let's look for early foreshadowing in this story. It's not difficult to find. Back in 1994, when Lori's and Robert's kids were little, the family packed up and moved a long way to California, doing so without having jobs lined up. Robert managed to get a job as a cook or a chef at a country club, but was fired shortly thereafter, though I don't know why. In the aftermath, instead of telling Lori he got fired and sulking a bit before going back out to find another job, he took off. He just disappeared, leaving her with the children. A few weeks later, he calls saying that he lost his job and was ashamed to tell her because he would have to admit he couldn't take care of his family, and that's why he left. He goes on to lament that he was going to return once he found more work and made money and wasn't ashamed to face them anymore. Please, let's get real. With all due respect, he seems to have abandoned them in favor of taking off on his own and starting again. Until he realized the only way forward in a straight line was to face it, grow up, and change. Otherwise, he'd be hiding like this from her forever, running forever, going nowhere but in circles. The truth isn't that he planned to come back, it's that he left, and once he did, like many men, realized he had nothing without his family. There wasn't any freedom to be found, so he went back on his hands and knees, so to speak, and learned from it. And he stays. He works hard. He raises these three boys with his wife. But if you were a guy who was already struggling very badly to not run away from this life years ago, just try to imagine how exhausted and fed up you'd be when one of those kids didn't ever grow up. I'm not talking about not growing up in the sense of like asking for money to buy a house or a loan to get a car. No, I mean, what if you were already struggling as a young father in 1994 and by 2013 there was no end in sight to your parenting because your middle son was a drug addict causing constant chaos in your home and in your head? This seems to have hit a crescendo for him in summer 2013. And again, you just look at Max's age, he's 23, which is basically like, you know, maybe a year older than you'd be when you got out of college as an undergrad, you know, and so when this kid is supposed to be like finished his education and moving into his life, he's still just using drugs. Now, While Mom Lori is away on a two-week vacation with friends in Turkey in July of 2013, Robert is at the house with Max. What this means is that the parents only have half the defense they normally do, and Max only faces half the opposition. So, one might imagine this is going to get ugly because what drug addict doesn't take advantage of a good situation like that, right? So, Max has been buying drugs in locations around Bridgeport nearby, but one in particular where there are abandoned buildings he can illegally strip for metal that can be recycled for cash. That's if he's willing to take the risk of being caught for trespassing. And, like most addicts, he certainly is. Now, with Mom gone, the family has both the Volkswagen Golf and a Mini Cooper at home, neither of which belongs to Max, but he borrows them sometimes. In fact, borrow is used lightly here because it seems that when he was denied, he just found a way to get the keys and take off anyhow. So, at some point, when Robert isn't around, Max takes advantage of being alone at the house and steals his parents' laptops, taking them to that location in Bridgeport to sell, though he refutes that, suggesting he only took them there to hide them in a building, at which point people stole them. I think we can see the truth. He sold them to get more drugs. Either way, Robert is pissed and also ashamed, as evidenced by his excessively apologetic tone with Lori over email to explain what had happened. He seems to have felt as though he let her down. And it's in that moment that we see the source of his pain, but more specifically, his exhaustion. He's 50 years old, has already raised three boys to adulthood, and simply can't keep pace with a young, desperate drug addict who's drawn him into a cycle of indulging false balance. He isn't going to get any rest from this. It's obvious it's getting worse, and he can't do anything to save his son. Again, let's go back to The Godfather. Michael Corleone doesn't transcend to being the Godfather while his father is alive. He wants nothing to do with that type of life while Dad is around and in charge. But once Dad is gone and a vacuum exists in which he must take on that role of the father, he transcends. Now, think of Max living in the house with his mom if Robert was to disappear. He, like Michael Corleone, would face the guilt of transcending out of necessity. Or not. But that circumstance, just like Robert's disappearance, forces a choice. Transcend, or the family dies. Because Mom can't support his habit on her own. She would drown in it over time, too. Not surprisingly, in the years following Robert's vanishing, Lori's asserted that Max got clean and is leading an adult life. Of course, we wouldn't be shocked to hear the opposite outcome either. But one way or another, it's clear Robert's disappearance is a catalyst that precipitates that choice for Max. But we need to examine this laptop incident because it truly insinuates foul play, and also take a look at Robert's choices in relation to his professions. It tells us a lot. Now, Robert, as a chef, is going to have to work a lot of long hours, and most likely well into the night, which isn't exactly daunting for a young man. But over time, unless you were being paid at a rate that made your job one that was virtually impossible to quit, you might begin to get tired, especially in the context of also raising three children. Now, Lori, Robert's wife, is in the same boat, of course. They met as a result of this passion for culinary arts in school, and it seems to have stayed with them throughout the years, even despite Robert's early troubles with the job I mentioned at the country club, where he was fired. In time, Lori becomes a teacher of culinary arts at Newtown High School, allowing her to make a sensible shift into career-level work that doesn't come with the demands of being a chef at a restaurant. It sounds like a perfect fit for her. Nights off, summers away from her desk, no sweating inside a hot kitchen late at night. And so Robert, of course, is looking for the same around that time in his life. But if he was having negative thoughts or even suicidal thoughts as a result of depression or some other related form of mental illness, those desires would likely manifest in his choice of profession when making his move, even if only in an indirect manner. So, we know in the past, back in 1994, Robert, upon getting fired, aka a career turning point, appraised the value of his home life and decided it was better to become independent from his wife and kids. In that light, he took off. He made the assessment. Upon doing so, he ironically learned that he was running toward an emotional prison and not freedom. Basically, he was wrong. So what we could fairly assert is that Robert, in the context of independence, made a mistake in appraising the value of the place he called home. Accordingly, when he leaves his career as a chef years later, just like he did the job at the country club to start that career, we know it's because he's feeling the same way. He wants out, not just of his home, but his family life, and as a result of the pressures and responsibilities. The emotional weight of abandoning his wife and young children, however, was too much for him in 1994, as he simply possessed empathy. But that's 1994. By 2013, the kids are adults and mom doesn't have to raise them. His empathy for her cause won't be as great. Same goes for his man-child son. If you leave behind a 3-year-old, that will haunt you. But a 23-year-old is grown. So at this time, when Robert leaves his career, we know he's going to make an assessment like he did in the past and ask, once again, what is my home life worth? And since the last time he asked himself, back in 1994, the answer led him to seeking greater independence, naturally, the same thing is going to manifest again. And if that's true, it means Robert will seek work as an independent real estate appraiser who places values upon homes. Not only that, but since he fucked it up last time and undervalued his home life, this time he'll get educated to do better. Of course, I don't even need to say this is what happened. It's exactly what he did. And just like last time, that freedom turned out to not be enough for Robert. He thought only of the freedom ahead, of the independence, and in doing so, overestimated its perceived value. Accordingly, he's going to get another job right on top of that. Now, in that light, his biggest problem is that his son Max has no work ethic and no future, and is also breaking the law to an extent that it's getting him into trouble. So, if you were his dad and already manifesting your emotional desires in your choice of job and suddenly realized you needed more emotional comfort and financial resources in order to compensate for your law-breaking, ambitionless son, you would take on a position suitable for him at age 23 and in the context of not only abiding the law, but making a good future for yourself. On that note, Robert takes a second job as a law clerk, emotionally compensating for Max's absent ambition and willingness to break the law. But guess what the 50-year-old finds out pretty quickly? Being a law clerk is much better suited to a younger, more energetic individual who doesn't need as much money. You know, like a 23-year-old, his son. And so Robert confides in a friend that this law clerk job is wearing him down, proving once again that his appraisal of its worth to him was entirely inaccurate. But look what we have. Appraisal of home life in relation to value. Robert is manifesting that reality and also taking on the work his son won't indulge. He's trying to work through the issues emotionally, but they're manifesting physically. Because he cannot change his son. Only his son can change, and so the circumstances don't change until Max does. Now, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out what happens next. In the past, back in 1994, Robert disappeared without a trace as a result of losing his job and deciding it was better to leave the wife and kids behind. In all honesty, I wouldn't be surprised at all if he simply quit that job and subsequently told his wife he was fired so he could use shame as an excuse for taking off. He might have just hated the job. I say that with no malice intended, of course, and simply as a matter of looking at the reality of the situation. He was a poor young man with three kids and a wife struggling to get by while serving food to rich people at a country club. He might have thought it would lead to something better, and merely led to him being exactly what he signed up for. The cook or chef at a country club who would play second fiddle to wealthy members. Yet, when we're young and we have our whole lives ahead of us and we feel trapped, taking off and starting a new life is going to seem like the best option on a practical level. When you're 50, however, and complaining of being tired, you're seeking rest, and we're going to see that symbolism manifested in the home when he's gone. Now, let's talk about the circumstances surrounding the theft of the laptops. Once Robert sorts through this mess and gets to the bottom of where Max took them and why, he puts his son in the car, grabs a lead pipe, and drives to those old abandoned buildings in Bridgeport to get his stuff back. Max blames the theft on two associates who deny involvement, and the laptops are gone forever. But we learn something interesting about Robert's feelings of inadequacy here, and his inability to teach the man-child to become a real man. Look at the weapon. Robert grabs a lead pipe. From guns to space rockets to police batons to penises, the straight line is the most wholly indicative feature of traditional masculinity. The ability to create a straight line with a great deal of potency, whether it's a career trajectory or an erection, is the defining trait of male transcendence to becoming the father. It satisfies two things. One, can you make kids? Two, can you raise them? The straight line going through the circle, which matches our evolutionary trajectory and also the plight of sexual intercourse with the penis heading toward the womb, makes two halves of the same whole, father and son, while the circle serves as the mother or womb. If you watch TV or movies in which there's a single man left standing at the end as the king of something, his name will often be represented by double D's. For example, at the end of the movie Boogie Nights, the last man standing is a porn star in front of a mirror, aka Mirror Universes, literally staring at the full extent of the straight line coming out of his pants. His name? Dirk Diggler. Double D. If you break a circle with a straight line going through it in half, getting two halves of the same whole, it makes two capital D's. So, another example with less of a sexual implication and more so one related to becoming the singularity, or God, is the character that Norman Reedus plays in The Walking Dead. All of the other men he started with at the beginning of the show are either dead or seemingly dead, and so, as the last man standing, his name is Daryl Dixon. Double D's. He's effectively the last man standing from the start, in the same way Dirk Diggler also has the longest straight line of anybody in the movie. That is, of course, also the reason that women tend to prefer tall men. Being taller makes you a longer straight line, which is symbolic of evolutionary strength, specifically long-term survival. If we break it down to its most fundamental value, a tall man is closer to God, so to speak, in the sky, and it's very much that simple. So if Robert Hoagland is feeling inadequate in that regard, and it's being exacerbated by the fact his son is suffering the same from a different perspective, he's going to manifest that long, stiff, straight line in the form of a lead pipe that he wields against his competition to try to take the respect he can't get otherwise. He's going to show up showing his straight line saying, "Hey man, I'm potent." The same thing you would do with a gun or a baseball bat. And Robert actually has a history of going after a few people with, guess what? A baseball bat. So, I mean, just think of this in the context of a paintball game where dudes are running around trying to tag each other with the paint from their guns to establish dominance. It's hilarious. It's like a bunch of dudes running around having an orgy, ejaculating all over each other. It's that ridiculous. And so the truth is that we're barely more sophisticated than the hairy apes that preceded us on the evolutionary ladder, so to speak. And when older animals become ill, tired or simply inadequate with age, what they often do is stray from the pack in order to go off and die somewhere. They do this because trying to stay with the others is futile. Not only does the weak animal make them a target, but it also slows them down, compromising their survival even further, which is why it's common to shun stragglers and even take measures to facilitate their deaths more quickly. Simply put, it's better for those who remain to be rid of the burden they bear. But that is a very primitive, natural sort of look at it. You know, that perspective is not something that infiltrates all of us on a social level. In the woods, hell yeah. Now, a chain is only as strong as its weak link. Same goes for a pack of animals or a family of people. The Corleones were never any stronger than their middle son Fredo's weakness. And the same goes here for the Hoagland's with Max. They too had three sons, just like the Corleones, and one of them cannot get his shit together to the extent he's holding everyone else back. Fredo's weakness makes him turn on his family in the movies, in the same way Max's weakness of addiction causes him to lie and steal from his family. Now, what was Fredo's emotional wound? He didn't get to transcend to become the father, aka the boss, because he had always been a sickly child. Now, that's Max. They passed him over. He remained in that purgatory. Of course, again, he was also the middle child, and like Max, had a weakness. He was sick, and he was never able to get out of that place. In fact, he died there, not coincidentally, because he tried to transcend to being the father through manifested physical means in the form of attempting to assassinate his brother Michael. So, we know right here, as Robert and Max get in the car to go confront the alleged thieves, that Robert can't make Max a man or even make himself feel more adequate by showing up and levying threats with a metal penis. To prove that, we notice it's not a gun which fires live rounds, but a pipe which emits nothing. It does not have the ejaculatory effect of a gun or even a bow and arrow. And of course, it has no effect. They come home empty-handed. He's shooting blanks, or nothing at all. No laptops. And the reason is that they didn't confront the truth. They confronted two phantoms who essentially were mirror universes for them. These are manifestations of who they are. They went and confronted these two horrible people. I mean, could Max have sold them the laptops? Yes, he probably did. But the problem doesn't stem from other people's actions. The problem is Max. Yet Robert is confronting the manifestation of Max's emotional problems instead, in the form of these two avatars. There was no buyer for these laptops without first having someone sell them, which was precipitated by theft. And Max was seemingly the one who perpetrated the theft. So Robert is forced to take the loss and emails Lori on vacation to apologize profusely for his inability to prevent it from happening. Again, look at him apologizing for his inadequacy in being unable to stop his son from doing this, yet the obvious solution is to get his son out of the house. It's clear why he's so tired. But check this out. Remember before when Robert took off and his wife was left with the kids in the past? Look what's happening now. He's stuck at home with this troubled child, and his wife is on vacation, right? So he's almost in her shoes from what happened back then, and he's going to disappear. He's chasing his son around, cleaning up after this man-child's messes, like the kid is 3 years old, but he's actually 23, and the stakes have risen to a place violence might occur. The situation is completely out of control, and it's because they won't kick Max out. They won't make him responsible. So, if you've been appraising the value of remaining in this home once again, and desperately want the situation to end, in a context of freedom and independence, drawn from exhaustion, what do you do? Well, if you can't remove the problem from the house, you have to remove yourself. He came to that conclusion years back, and it brought him home when he tried to flee. But it's different all these years later. He wants to rest, maybe more than his family knows. It doesn't seem like they knew back in 1994. And he's going to tell them with a talisman, whether it was rationally placed or simply done so by way of nature's narrative affording us symbolic truth. Now, on July 25th, Robert goes to his bank and withdraws $600. It's too much to withdraw in cash for one day, and therefore it requires going inside the building to deal with a teller. That's about 3 days before he disappears. It's not exactly a large sum of money. Likewise, in 2013, it isn't insignificant either. Yet, here it becomes important because there will be no financial activity in relation to Robert's identity once he's gone. His debit or credit cards remain inactive. So he needed money, in cash, to make purchases that we assume were intended to be made that way as a means of not tracing his moves. It's not accounted for here. We don't know what happened to the $600. Now, shortly after this cash withdrawal, Robert receives an email from Lori on vacation in Turkey, and it's asking him to pick her up at the airport on a certain day and at a certain time. Robert was expecting to have to do this even before the request, as it was discussed prior to Lori leaving, and so it seems like he never responded to her confirmation email, which she said, She said that something like that would have been normal for him, and she simply assumed he'd be at the airport on July 29th. He wasn't. Yet, while she didn't hear from him, apparently he was telling friends who inquired that he did, in fact, intend to pick Lori up from the airport July 29th. In the meantime, the morning of July 28th arrives. It's the last day Robert and Max will be alone at the house before Mom comes back. Robert goes out in the morning, fills the Mini Cooper with gas at about 6:45 a.m., buys a map of the eastern United States at the mobile station, and picks up a bag of bagels before returning home to share breakfast with Max. Now, remember the silly manifestation of the lead pipe as a penis with no ability to create? Well, the two of them are about to team up again for something even more ridiculous in terms of manifesting another reality physically that they can't achieve emotionally. The problem Max is having as the addict, and the one his father experiences from the other side of the fence as the one trying to help, comes down to the notion of indulging cyclical behavior that keeps your life going in circles. In order to change, you must break the circles with emotional change. So if Max wants to get out of the cycle, and so does Dad, Dad needs to take a stand that forces Max to make a decision to sink or swim, hoping that succeeds. But since Max isn't trying to emotionally mature to break the cycle, or circle, and leave the home along the straight line of evolution as a man, transcending to become the father, simply because his father is indulging him, one of them has to go. You break the cycle by removing one of the elements. And Robert doesn't have the heart to toss his kid out the door, even after the laptops incident. So what he's going to do is symbolically break the circle here, yet physically instead of emotionally, and then subsequently manifest his absence to try to force Max to transcend without imposing his will, just as happened in The Godfather. When Michael Corleone accepts his father is gone, and his older brother is too, while the middle child, Fredo, is incompetent, he realizes his destiny. He must transcend to become the father of the family. The problem with Robert trying to manifest that logic forcefully, however, is that Max is Fredo, not Michael, and can't transcend his issues just because there's an open spot at the top of the family for a top dog. Now, we can prove that he's incredibly fucking wrong because it's a fact that what happened in the aftermath is that the eldest son came home and became the father. He took over a lot of the responsibilities at home in the same way that James Caan would have in The Godfather, having transcended to be the Godfather, if he wasn't killed. So, structurally, this is what he's trying to manifest, but it isn't going to work because he's trying to make the story work with Fredo at the top. But that's not the place that Fredo ends up. Now again, life is a series of soft circles and hard straight lines. As a small boy, when my father would take me fishing, and I was too young to do it well enough to enjoy it, I would often find myself skipping rocks on the water, but more importantly, wondering why I found such great joy in skipping a rounded object across a straight line in which the circle touched down to rest in the places where it wasn't flying. It's just like us. We keep our feet on the ground back at the circle, our home, where comfort is key. And on our evolutionary pathway, we fly ahead. Yet, what's most apparent from skipping the stone, aka you, the protagonist, is that if it stays in any one place for too long along the way, on the water, it will simply sink and do the equivalent of drowning. The rock will slip below the surface under the weight of its lack of inertia and remain stuck in darkness, unable to move, in a place where it slowly erodes in silence. That's our emotional life if we choose to remain inside the circle forever. We must fly, and we must come back down to Earth. That is our current trajectory, the straight line and circle. So if you're stuck in a circle or cycle and have to break it, yet you're also passionate about food and manifesting a false solution to your and your son's cyclical problems, what might you do to express that desire in images? How would you tell that story? Well, you'd buy a bag of edible circles, too many to consume that morning, so that when you left the rest behind, unable to break them, the symbolism left over would be apparent. The cycle was just too hard to break. The circles kept coming. Think of yourself holding a bagel. It's a circle. You bring it toward your mouth in a straight line and bite through the circle, creating a pathway to the literal emptiness inside it that matches the emotional emptiness in your head. There's a way out of the middle now on the bagel, representing a way out of the middle, or purgatory, or cycle, or circle, that these two men are stuck in at the time due to, again, the cycle of addiction. As they continue to eat, biting the bagels over and over, satisfying themselves, there will be less and less circle, and less emptiness inside them physically in their stomachs, until finally, when finished, the circle is gone forever. The bagel is the circle, symbolizing the cycle of addiction, and Robert is manifesting a circumstance in which he and his son can simply sit there, indulging his passion, food, as an easy means of physically and symbolically attempting to consume that which is truly consuming them. Being trapped in this cycle, their weakness, is figuratively eating them. So given that Robert's passion, his strength, is food, the number one option for satisfactory manifestation here is actual consumption of a circle in the form of food, as seen in the bagel. This is so deeply ingrained in our construction that while writing a script recently, my protagonist, whose life had been going in circles, chose to try to turn to safety inside a donut shop that was, not coincidentally, called the Donut Den, Double D. She's banging on the glass to get inside and escape her problems, but the employee whose attention she wants is ignoring her in favor of making more circles. And it's because she's trying to run and hide rather than evolve. There is no safety within those walls, so she can't get inside to attain it, but thinks she can because she's manifesting a physical reality from an emotional issue. It's destined to fail. And it does. The difference is a disparity between want and need. We want the comfort of the circle, but need the growth of the straight line. The skipping rock only sits long enough on the water that it won't sink and then takes flight again. Otherwise, it goes under and never comes up. All the rocks sink in the end, but the ones that are properly propelled and shaped are the ones that stay afloat and fly longest. Those are normally rocks that have allowed the water in the river to shape them, rocks that have reacted to adversity by becoming less rigid over time. People are the same way. We, like the rock in the river, need to allow the world to shape us in the manner that suits it, rather than how we envision wanting to be formed, as we cannot control the flow of life coming at us. We can only allow time to pass while facing the adversity coming our way. We cannot stop it, which is exemplified in the same manner by the fact the rocks couldn't hope to stifle the river's advances. The lesson nature delivers within is clear. If you face adversity like the rock faces the water's current coming at it, and accept that it shapes you against your will, but out of necessity, you'll find comfort in indulging the change over time. The straight lines of the jagged rock will literally be transformed into a smooth circle. So think of it this way. Ask yourself, why has the river afforded so many beautiful circles from jagged rocks, perhaps to a greater extent than anything else in nature? Well, look what it manifests through physicality. All of those beautiful circles form for a specific reason, one that is absolutely undeniable in the most symbolic way. The rocks form as circles because the river never stops moving relentlessly forward in a straight line, so much so that the rocks are actually more like ovals than circles from being pulled so hard in that trajectory of the straight line. If the river stopped flowing, it would also stop making circles. No straight line equals no circle. So the idea is to have a circle, or many circles, like your home, from which you take flight along a straight line into the world to face adversity that will facilitate your ability to maintain the comfort of your circles. Just like the river. So since Robert can't get his son to break the cycle of addiction, aka the circle of comfort, and can't bring himself to do it forcefully by evicting the kid onto the streets, he's decided to manifest this in a way that the rest of us sometimes hilariously do without bad intentions, which is to try to eat our problems. We get depressed and eat. But here, the target is specific in the sense that the thing they need to break is the cycle of addiction. Robert is going to sit down with his son and indulge the physical consumption of these symbolic circles that have consumed them emotionally. It's revenge, trying to balance to zero. You took from me, I take from you. And he isn't going to confirm to his wife that he'll be at the airport to pick her up, because it isn't true. He's not going to be there. Now, once he eats and is on the verge of disappearing, we know Robert is going to leave us a puzzle to solve in the aftermath. And that's symbolized by his choice of activity at that time. His computer suggests he was playing Scrabble. And of course, what do you look for in Scrabble? The right words. You try to figure out the right words to display for other people to see. And Robert simply does not have the words to tell his family what he's about to do. So it's manifesting in this activity of looking for the right words. After Scrabble, Robert goes outside and mows the lawn. While out there, he's seen by a neighbor who says Max is out there with him at the time. Max agrees that this is correct and suggests that that's when he left in the Volkswagen Golf to go take care of business. But Robert is never seen again. He seems to have finished mowing the lawn and then placed the lawnmower back in the garage at its normal spot before taking off his sneakers and putting them right next to it. Robert supposedly preferred loafers and wore them almost exclusively, with the exception being when he mowed the grass. Now, upon searching the house in the aftermath, his loafers were found, and so were a second pair he sometimes wore. There's nothing to suggest he wore shoes when leaving. The police didn't find any evidence of a struggle at the home, nor did they believe anything was missing above and beyond the stolen laptops. That's not exactly a sign that drug addicts came to his home looking for revenge or even to rob him. Addicts want things that can be converted to cash quickly, and burglarizing a home goes a long way toward that goal. An altercation, of course, between father and son is almost certainly out of the question as well, as the police simply found nothing to suggest a violent crime, from kidnapping to murder, took place. Now, Max suggests that he told his dad he was going out in the golf and had permission. That's the conversation the neighbor saw taking place on the lawn, we assume, though the neighbor did not hear the content of the conversation. But this is just a few days after the laptops were stolen, a crime Max clearly facilitated through usage of the golf, again, we assume, which he drove to Bridgeport to get drugs. So, if that happened, you'd think Dad refused, you know, in terms of letting him take the car, and maybe an argument took place in which the son needed his drugs at any cost, up to and including Robert's life. Of course, things like that can happen, and often do. The issue here is that there is absolutely no evidence that could be used to formulate a circumstance in which it actually did. And that isn't very likely when your son is a fucking mess. Right? Like, this isn't somebody who's like some calculating serial killer. This is someone who is very sloppy, on drugs, and, you know, if you're under the impression that you can steal your parents' laptops and just say you didn't do it, you're not exactly a master criminal. So I don't foresee any sort of situation in which Max would have been able to perpetrate a violent crime against his father and clean it up in a manner that the cops wouldn't know. It just seems unrealistic. And anybody else he dealt with was essentially the same type of person, and they would have left the same. So I don't see any reason to believe that a crime was committed, especially a violent crime. My initial impression is that Robert abandoned his family once again, as he had back in 1994. But what really seals the deal for me is what happened soon after. He disappears without a trace on July 28th, and without calling Lori. She gets picked up at the airport by family living in Brooklyn as she flew into New York from Turkey. She doesn't get a hold of him, and Max says he hasn't seen his dad since July 28th. That happens on the night of July 29th, so Max hasn't seen his dad for the better part of 2 days. You might ask, well, why the hell isn't he concerned? The answer, as already proven, is that the drugs are more important than anything else. So if Max has the rare opportunity to not be hassled by mom or dad and just take the car and go get drugs and not worry about permission, he's taking it. Accordingly, Max is found at that abandoned building complex in Bridgeport on the night of July 29th, waiting around to buy drugs when cops arrive. He knew his mom was coming home and would assume the role of finding his dad. This is a drug-addicted man-child who isn't going to take charge in rough times. He gets arrested, I believe for trespassing, and when asked if he had permission to take the car, he says yes. He asked his mother. His mother, of course, refutes that and says that he did not have permission. And of course, you know, who are we going to believe, mom or the drug addict? We're going with mom. And again, this isn't odd for them. This is a pretty normal thing. He's been taking this car, you know, on and off the whole time, and with mom out of town, it just becomes that much easier. So it's pretty normal that he would just say to the cops, yeah, my mom gave me permission, because maybe they wouldn't follow up on it. But obviously, if the car belongs to her and dad's no longer around, they're going to. But there isn't anything embedded in that behavior that leads me to believe that he's being overly suspicious in a way that might be related to a violent crime. It's very typical behavior for a drug addict. So again, Lori comes home, and to the best of her understanding, she believes perhaps Robert took off again. She remembers 1994, how couldn't she? Now this is where it gets a little strange. On August 6th, about a week later, while cleaning the couple's bedroom, Lori picks up a doll that's sitting on a chair, and underneath it, she finds Robert's wallet and keys. Lori immediately thinks that Robert left them there as a means of hiding them from Max, so the addict couldn't take the Mini Cooper or steal money from him. But we have to delve deeper into our apparent themes to see the truth here. What is a doll in its simplest essence? It's an inanimate human. We could say that another way by suggesting the doll isn't alive. Now, if the doll is sitting in a chair, even though it isn't alive, we understand it's indulging the concept of rest. Rest, in the context of not being alive or inanimate, and as it pertains to humanity, is death. So we have an inanimate, aka dead human, who sat down because he wanted to rest. If we remove the doll from its resting place, aka the chair, we learn its hidden identity along with why it's there. Accordingly, Robert's wallet is there to identify the dead guy who wanted to rest because the doll can't do it for him. And then what we really want to know, above and beyond what happened, is why it did. So Robert leaves behind his car keys, symbolizing his inability to move forward. There's nowhere left to go along the road of life. His river has run dry. It no longer flows into the future. My best guess is that this man planned his disappearance in advance, more likely for the purpose of suicide, with it being less likely, but still possible, that he ran away and started a new life. It might sound romantic to run off and get a fresh start, but when you're 50 years old, hate your job, and are tired from decades of cleaning up after your kids' messes, while also complaining about working too hard to get money, your options for that new beginning are severely limited, and you are not nearly as idealistic as you might have been back in 1994 when you were young. Throw in the fact this happened in the last 10 years, well within the introduction of sophisticated social media, smartphones, and tracking of all kinds, and it doesn't seem very likely a man with $600 in his pocket would get too far. And I think that's the point. $600 sounds like a pair of boots, a bus ticket, and minimal other travel to a place where you know you can die and never be found. I find this case to be very much like the Ray Grecar story. An aging, tired man who is by no means old, but is truly exhausted, mentally drained, and not looking for a fresh start other than the closest exit leading to peace. Balance of positive and negative charges. He's tired of the circle. He just wants to rest. But again, he's ashamed. This happens a lot in the world, and it's okay, but we do everything we can to alter the perception of someone being tired and wanting to rest as being mental illness. We suggest they just need help, to talk to someone who will stop them from it. And that shit is exactly what people walking in those shoes don't want to hear, because they're tired of walking in those shoes. Robert literally and symbolically tells us that by leaving his favorite shoes, and in fact, all of his shoes, behind. He'll walk that path no more. His shoes are still there. His car is there. His blood pressure medication is there. His identity is there. He left it all behind him because he didn't need it anymore. That's what we do when we die. Now, just look at his last activity before he left the home, no matter how the disappearance happened. Robert mowed the lawn. Why would he do that? What was he saying? Well, it's twofold. If the green grass grows, there's symbolic growth at your home. But if you mow the lawn, you're the cause of stifling growth or preventing it. That's part of Robert's shame as it pertains to his emotional wound. He believes his presence as an enabler is preventing Max's growth, specifically denying him transcendence to becoming his own man, aka the father. When the grass grows tall and gets out of control, in the same way a child would grow tall to a man-child and get out of control, Robert chops it down to a manageable level. That's the same thing he's been doing for this kid over and over and over again. Robert, however, feels guilty for contributing to that cycle. But watch what happens. If he leaves, what will follow? He's gone and no longer mows the lawn, meaning he is also symbolically no longer preventing growth at his home in his absence and no longer responsible for chopping down that grass when it gets out of control from growing tall. If he isn't there to mow the grass, aka enable Max, the grass and Max will grow. And if it grows out of control, someone else is going to have to take care of it. That's the point. Basically, Robert is breaking the cycle or circle by leaving home, reversing the normal process of the parents pushing the kid out the door in order to get Max to mature. Again, I believe he most likely succumbed to a planned suicide, something that wouldn't be incredibly difficult to conceal given his fondness for maps, forest areas, and hiking. There's an endless terrain full of mystery in the northeastern U.S. On the other hand, it is possible he started a new life, but that's not what I see. I think Robert was looking for a way out that might serve the dual purpose of forcing his son to mature. In the end, Robert was never seen again, and Max got clean. So my assessment is that Robert intentionally disappeared to facilitate not only his long-suffering exit from the life he lived in the form of his suicide, but also Max's transcendence to accepting adult responsibility through emotional growth. As they were involved in the same cycle of behavior, Robert removing himself as an enabler forced Max to take on an adult role to survive. And apparently he did. Robert left behind everything but $600 and his own body. If you ask me, that sounds like exactly the right price to get you to a place you need to rest. And no further. I believe that's what happened in this case. Robert left without anything that could identify him directly, such as a wallet or even his usual clothes. To me, this suggests he was going to commit suicide in a concealed environment in which he knew he wouldn't be found in the short term, but perhaps could be over time. If a hunter found him 20 years later and his wallet or shoes were on him, we'd know who he was. But if it happens in a manner in which only his scarce remains are discovered, the chances of identification and determining cause of death are very low. This seems like a strange thing to do, but some people are so ashamed of the decision to commit suicide that they would prefer to disappear with the event shrouded in mystery that might never be solved beyond its obvious implications. And that's the point. He's using cyclical logic. He wants his family to know, and to the same extent, he doesn't. The best way to do that is to remain in the middle, on the fence, and in the true construction of a circle, look where that takes us. Right back to the beginning, to where Robert, Lori, and Max created their purgatory. Robert wants us to leave this story on the fence between believing this was a suicide and believing it was foul play. He wants to trap us in the cycle with him. He wants us to remain embedded in the baffling mystery in the middle, unable to transcend to truth. So at this fork in the road, I walk the path of suicide as truth. Robert succumbed to his struggles. And although it's impossible for us to get inside his head, or even Max's mind, I'm guessing the emotional disposition that plagued Robert early in his adulthood, to the point of running away, as an ailment that was passed on to his son genetically, one that led Max to indulging drugs to cope. We don't know for sure, but given the level of shame involved, it's probable. I think of them eating from that bag of bagels at the end like they had the same cyclical problem that was consuming them and symbolically wanted to destroy it by finally, once and for all, turning the tables and figuratively consuming the issue instead. Given that the incident involves Robert's passion, food, I believe this is correct. And as I said earlier, there is likely an emotional connection to the Sandy Hook massacre months earlier, in the sense that the notion of a child never growing to adulthood is too painful to bear as a parent. When kids die young, or even when they die after reaching adulthood, their parents will go back and cherish the photos and other memories of when everything was still okay. Max didn't start his life as a drug addict. He was a baby first, and then a little boy who needed to be protected. And as a parent, how the hell do you let go of a grown child you can't protect and who, ironically, can't survive on their own? I don't know how to answer that. If in Robert's shoes, I think I would have done the same thing. I would have both ironically enabled Max and denied him, indulging a cyclical pattern of behavior from which there would be no escape unless someone was finally willing to break the cycle and go. How do you kick that adult out the door while having such beautiful memories of them as a child in the past? Some people can answer that question. They have the courage to let go and find out. Others don't. The Hoaglands couldn't manage. How do you learn to love in a way that your only option is to let go and hope that the attic doesn't crash and burn, and in a situation in which it seems that that will obviously happen? I honestly don't know. And clearly, Robert didn't either. Same thing goes for Lori. Something had to break. Change had to happen, one way or another. And it did. This time, however, Robert hasn't picked up the phone and asked to return, like he did back in 1994. He's gone, the better part of a decade now, whether that means dead or having started anew. Whichever it is, he's out there somewhere. But until we find him, the only truth we know for sure is that he wanted to make all the bad things go away. Like a scared child, the one hiding behind the adult masks we all see in the mirror, the ones we wish we could strip off, and then desperately run back to a place in time called home that no longer exists, except in distant memories, if it ever did at all. Images in our minds and on our photos of when we were children, a time which is gone, yet somehow lives forever, that dies, but is often resurrected. This place in our hearts is a ray of hope from afar that draws us near, like a lighthouse waiting to guide us to shore, where solid ground is under our feet once again. I think Robert saw that place in his dreams and followed the path to peace. Maybe that's why we want to know where he went. He's in a place where the monsters can't get him anymore. Safe. Whether we realize it or not, that's what we've searched for since we were old enough to be afraid of the dark. As kids, we dealt with that fear by turning on the lights. Once you do that, they can't get you. So while you're here on this earth, in our universe, illuminate your life. Create as much shine as you can. Brighten the world and bring love into your house, so that when the horrible monsters show up looking for a place to conceal themselves, they won't find any darkness. There will be nowhere left to hide from you.